Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talked to Adrian Crowder, who is the manager of the Wellington Guelph Drug Strategy. We've heard a lot about one health crisis this year, the one tied to a global pandemic that broke the economy, brought healthcare to the brink, and pretty much shut down society for 4 months earlier this year. But while COVID has been our preoccupation in 2020, there has been another public health issue in our community at the same time, and it's one that started before the pandemic but has stayed with us through the darkest days of the last 10 months. Issues with drug dependency and the problems associated with it have continued, but without the same level of attention as the coronavirus, and the problems facing people with drug addictions are not entirely separate from the COVID-19 pandemic itself. The other pandemic of 2020 is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. The ongoing issues of drug addiction in Guelph came to the fore once again last week with two items in the news. On Wednesday, Wellington Dufferin Guelph Public Health issued a warning about another overdose death in Guelph related to fentanyl, possibly related to the reappearance of the very potent red version of fentanyl in our community. Then on Friday, Guelph Police Service announced that they had successfully arrested 16 people, 15 of them from Guelph, on 34 drug-related charges, which resulted in the seizure of fentanyl, cocaine, pot, crystal meth, and over $3,600 in cash. These are the stories that break through the news cycle. But what about all the daily stories of struggle and suffering by those afflicted with addiction? Are those people still able to get the help they need? That answer is complicated. The consumption and treatment site never closed at any point in the pandemic, but were the people that might have been helped by the CTS fully aware of that fact? Hopefully they were, but there's reason to think that they didn't, because a report from Public Health Ontario in June noted a nearly 40% increase in the number of overdose deaths in the first 15 weeks of the pandemic. Most of those deaths were accidental in nature, and many of them are being driven by circumstances exacerbated by the pandemic itself. Feelings of isolation and loneliness, depression, listlessness, and in some cases a tainted drug supply caused, in part, by the closed border with the United States. The COVID-19 pandemic has made our drug and overdose pandemic worse, and unlike the reaction to COVID-19, there has not been such a swift and immediate reaction to the drug crisis. So what would it take to change all that? Well, we found the right person to talk to about these and other similar questions on this week's Guelph Politicast. Adrian Crowder will talk about the number of overdoses in Guelph and Wellington this year, how support services have had to adjust in the pandemic, and where the fight for addiction recovery might be now if it wasn't for COVID-19. We will also talk about the ways COVID has impacted addiction issues, including the ways it's affected the fight to get more support for fighting those issues, and how the pandemic has impacted mental health issues that are so key to understanding addiction itself. And finally, we will look ahead to what advocates are concerned about this winter for people who are drug users, and what the long-term impacts of COVID might be on both stigma and getting long-term support to fight addiction issues. So I caught up with Adrian Crowder last week via Zoom. So Adrian Crowder, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Adam, and thank you for the invite.
I guess just to start with the basics, how many overdoses have we seen in our area this year in Guelph, Wellington, and how does that compare to recent years?
Okay, well, I'll give you the numbers that I'm working with, and one of the challenges is that they aren't final until we get the coroner's report. So the numbers that we're working with this year so far, year to date, we're in the beginning of December. So we have very sadly had 22 fatal overdoses in Guelph this year. The numbers from last year were considerably less. There's a little bit of a question mark around what those numbers are. We were working with the number 7, which was what we knew of. And then the coroner's report came back and had actually raised that number a little bit. There were some other cases that had not come to the light of public health collection process. But what we know is that it's a very sizable increase. There was a recent report out of the Ontario Drug Policy and Research Network, and Guelph was one of 6 areas in Ontario where there's been a significant increase statistically in the number of fatal overdoses. So sadly, it's a, you know, I mean, there's just a lot of ripple effect from that particular statistic in terms of people in the community who've been lost, and for their family, their friends, the people who work with them. And it's a very significant number.
I mean, this may be a bit of editorializing, but when you said 22, I was more than a little shocked, and I try to keep one eye on this. And it reminds me too that, you know, I was at the Ward 1 town hall a couple of weeks ago with the police chief, and there are a lot of people upset about a couple of homicides earlier this year, and there was another stabbing a couple of weeks ago. That was 3. This is 22. And it feels like we weigh the one more than the other.
We do. And, you know, I mean, across Ontario, again, just to give this some context. I was on a recent webinar, and the Ontario Coroner's Office was dropping some data on us. And their data was that there's been a 50% increase in fatal overdoses in 2020 over 2019, 50%. So they're estimating in Ontario, roughly 2,300 people will have lost their lives due to substance overdose, primarily fentanyl, and fentanyl's mixed with benzos. So someone working in this field, back in 2016, our drug strategy locally and drug strategies across the province were part of a campaign that was really inviting the chief medical officer of health, Dr. David Williams, to declare an epidemic in substance use challenges. And that's 4 years ago. For a little while, things were getting a little bit better. And then with the pandemic, things have completely reversed and gone in, you know, all the trending is heading in the wrong direction, in the sense of more people are overdosing, more people are fatally overdosing, the drug supply has gotten more toxic, the services available are fewer. So it just, it's become a really, you know, I feel the word that was going to pop out is dire. For me, it feels, working in the role that I work in, it's a dire situation.
Mm-hmm. It strikes me too, and, you know, thinking about this before we started talking today, but, you know, when we go back to the start of 2020, I'm not going to say that we were close to, you know, wiping out, you know, drug overdoses and the drug pandemic here in Guelph, but it seemed like we were a little bit further ahead. You know, we had the support recovery room opening finally. We have, you know, welcoming streets. We have the addiction court support worker, like all these things that came out of the mayor's task force. We were one of the first to get the CTS up and going. Naloxone, I mean, there's good community engagement on that. A lot of businesses downtown have a
even kit. Our school board, like Upper Grand, approved naloxone in the schools, which again I think is, you know, compared to many school boards, very progressive.
Right. And I guess what I think about is, you know, what would be different now if we didn't have COVID sort of like sucking up all the attention? Not that it did deserve the attention, of course, it's a global pandemic, but I mean, it really seemed that COVID hit and threw everything else off track. And I wonder, you know, how would this conversation be different if we were talking about this and COVID wasn't an issue right now?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that has remained the same is our local agencies continue to, you know, pioneer and push and work hard to come up with good answers to hard problems. So that hasn't changed. You know, I think all the local services have really done very quick responses to try and meet local needs. So that hasn't changed, but the environment they're working in has changed. And so the kinds of supports that perhaps were there in January that weren't there as of March or April, a lot of organizations really had to balance the staff health versus client health. So a lot of organizations, at least for a couple of months, really pulled staff all in-house. Some weren't really clear what their service model was going to be. It really left people in who were on the receiving end, the client end, in a place where they weren't sure what was happening. A lot of time, the service they wanted certainly wasn't available in the way they were used to. Everything from being able to hang out at the library to being able to go and see a primary care doctor at the Guelph CHC to, you know, to just, there were just so many things that shifted around in terms of hours and availability and all those things. And then we also know that the drug supply got disrupted. And, you know, the border was closed, planes weren't flying. And what's available on the street is more and more toxic. There's a project out of St. Mike's in Toronto that is doing drug checking. It's a federally funded Health Canada project. And they take analysis from five different consumption treatment sites in Toronto, and they're able to demonstrate quite clearly that the types of drugs that are available on the unregulated market are getting more and more toxic, and that adds to the kind of the logistical problems and the service problems. That so people have fewer supports, they also have more dangerous supply. And it's just been a really bad mix in terms of for folks who have addiction, and they don't really have a choice about whether they use or not. The options are not good for them. They need to use. And it's so from the drug strategy perspective, that the challenge of addiction not being given the recognition as a health problem has been very difficult.
And they're getting it from both sides. They can't get the normal help that they might seek. The drug supply that's available isn't as quote unquote safe as it might usually be.
Yeah, obviously it's a black market, so nobody's doing quality control. But what is available is less and less predictable, and the avenues that people get their drugs have gotten disrupted. So, I mean, people used to have a fair amount of faith in their dealer to be selling them something that was a known substance. And that, you know, and it's not that the ability to kind of guarantee that level of control is gone. And I also want to point out that, I mean, the lack of support, there have been some really heroic efforts to increase support. So when folks who were living in the shelter system were provided with rooms through hotels and now through Loyola House, that has allowed for services to be brought on site in a way that they were not before. And so there have been, there's now a nurse out at the shelter site, Loyola House, 5 days a week, which is amazing, because that brings a service that a lot of people can benefit from that wasn't there before. There have been additional outreach workers that through the money, the community emergency support funds that the United Way and Guelph Community Foundation have provided. These are new roles that have been able to be provided. So it's been this odd mix. I mean, there's in some circles, there's more availability of support, but for people who are not connected into those circles, people who are, perhaps using in the general community, it's been the risks have gotten a lot bigger.
Yeah, I'm just curious about that aspect of it, because for a lot of people who have limited means but are also drug users, maybe they don't have access to a phone, maybe they don't have access to a computer, maybe their access to the computer was at the library, which was closed for 4 or 5 months. So when you're reaching out to them, I mean, and just when you're kind of out and about and sort of generally looking around and everywhere is closed, even the places, you know, you would typically have access to
a washroom
facility are all closed, like the city hall, the park washrooms are closed. And then you're trying to get the word out to them like, no, if you need to use and you need a safe space to use, the CTS is still open and available, which it was during the course of the lockdown in the spring. I mean, how do you get the word out? How do you... Yeah. You know, make people aware that they can still get help.
Yeah, and well, I mean, you're just identifying a really big challenge, which is that, you know, people often do not have the, you know, most of us are using digital means to stay connected, and people either don't have it or they had it today, it might be stolen and they don't have it tomorrow. So it's definitely complicated. Now that, you know, again, there've been, I think, just huge big pats on the back to services like Welcoming Streets and the, you know, the outreach workers, the SOS outreach workers and other groups that have really, they've really worked super hard over the last little while, trying to make those connections, trying to reach people who are sleeping rough or who aren't well supported. There's been a lot of effort made, and the CTS has stayed open throughout and is now, I think, coming back. It's actually about to expand. I believe they've received some monies to expand. So that service really has been quite consistent. Again, it's not always accessible to someone. If someone is living in the west end of Guelph or they're in South Guelph, it's getting downtown in a regular way may not be feasible for them.
Right. And I mean, for a while there was no more than 10 people allowed on the bus. And if you're using the bus to get around and you're perhaps not aware of the rules of riding the bus, you know, that you have to wear a mask, there was only 10 people at a time. The reduced schedule, even, it's just everything you do to try and get help, there's another barrier.
I mean, I think often like with substance use, there's still such judgment. And I think if people take the time to really sort of understand the process and understand that cycle of use and withdrawal, and how when withdrawal is about to drop, people are not in a place where they can sit around and consider options. They've got, you know, and so again, just the situation you're describing, someone who needs to get on a bus to get themselves downtown within a certain timeline and they don't catch that bus. And then, you know, they end up using behind the corner store and people are horrified. And, you know, I mean, I understand if, you know, if it's not what anybody wants or welcomes, but I think if people were to, you know, often I think there's this misunderstanding. There's a lot of, there's just a lot of judgment. And there's also a lot of sense that people should abstain and they've done it to themselves. And, you know, that there's not much understanding that once addiction becomes a physiological problem, it's just like a heart attack. Someone can't stop it. They can't say, I don't want that today. The point of choice is no longer there. And, you know, and at that point, we're just putting people in these very, very dire places. I mean, we wouldn't do that with someone like a heart attack and say, sorry, we can't take you to Emerge. You've got to go, you know, you've got to go to the other end of town first. Right. And then you need to do three errands. And if you've done those, come back, right? Like, we just don't create those kinds of barriers for other disease processes. But within our current world and system, we are still doing that for folks who struggle with addiction.
And, you know, speaking of the stigma too, I can't imagine that's been helped by the pandemic, because people can say, oh, you're a drug user. Well, we have real problems. There's a global pandemic. And, you know, it then becomes like a weighted system of like, do you value helping people with COVID? Do you value helping drug users? Like, we can't do both at the same time.
Yeah. And that idea that it is a, you know, it's a kind of zero sum game and you got to help one group or the other. And I'm personally not sure that that's really, that's necessary. I mean, it's just sitting in a drug strategy role, it has been really challenging to watch how quickly we can respond in a pandemic relatively to what we have not done for people who struggle with, addiction. And untreated mental health and addiction is pretty massive in our culture, and we've somehow turned a blind eye to that, but we get very excited about a virus. So it, you know, watching what's happening, I sort of in preparing to talk with you today, I was just thinking through some of the things that are so different. And so tracking, we know day to day how many people in Guelph have had a new infection of COVID. We know how many people have died from COVID. We know what the 7-day rates are. And a lot of us as citizens, without even trying to be very expert at this, know a fair amount about what's going on. With addiction, we wait months for the coroner's report to come back to tell us whether or not someone died of a substance use issue. It's never publicly, there's nothing in the paper that says, you know, and we've lost another of our community members to an overdose. There's like, unlike the COVID count, apparently it's okay to count deaths from a virus, but you don't publicly count deaths from an overdose. So the whole kind of tracking and the ability to get real data quickly and in a timely way and to have it drive decisions is not there when it comes to addiction. You know, that whole timeliness thing, like we are waiting months for we have a running count based on what public health's great FAST system is telling us, but we have to wait for the coroner's report to come back to verify that. So there's this big time lag. By the time that report comes back, the actual person who lost their life is kind of, that's history, right? There's not that connection between this was a real person And this was a statistic, so that happens. Just in terms of resources, I mean, I don't even really know where to begin. I mean, we've created vaccines in 10 months, we collectively, I mean, globally. Right. But things like CERB, support for businesses and renters, all the things that were suddenly mobilized. And we've had an opioid crisis for 4 years. And we don't even have basic housing in place for people, despite the fact we've been pushing for that for a long time. People don't have a living wage. So when people find their cars broken into and various other things, I think they're maybe not recognizing that there's no other source of finance for someone who's in that situation. So just watching the resources get thrown into our culture and having sat watching an opioid crisis and not having seen, not even the recognition that there is a kind of public emergency happening, even though we have a 50% increase in this year, according to the coroner, over last year. And we pivoted so quickly with the virus, and we seem to be so unable to move to a place of understanding that we could shift to support people who are struggling with addiction. Addiction and often mental health too. It's a bit baffling. It's like, what would it take? What kind of understanding would it take for folks to get that an illness is an illness is an illness, dead is dead, and we have these preventable deaths that we're not preventing. And it just, there are things we can do that would make a difference, but we're not doing them. So it's been a very challenging year for someone like in the position like I have, because you think, how would you message this better? Or what we say, and it's a local issue, but it's also a provincial and federal issue. There's all these layers that have to find a way to connect with each other. Our federal government has been actually really quite supportive in terms of moving to take action, but we still have to get coordination through provincial supports. We have to bring it down to a local level. I mean, there's just it's been a challenge to watch this.
But I mean, that's also a symptom of stigma, isn't it?
Totally.
I mean, even in cases where, you know, we see this in the United States more than we see it in Canada, although we do see it in Canada, people gathering in groups, these anti-mask protests where people are standing close, breathing on each other, getting each other infected. There isn't the stigma. I mean, you can go on Twitter and see people, you know, grouse, of course, but there just isn't the stigma. If someone goes to the hospital with COVID, whether they got COVID through their own recklessness or because they work in a long-term care or nursing home, they are treated the same. You can't say the same thing about a drug user.
Yes, I know. And again, if you or any of your listeners can come up with the magic bullet that would shift the belief and understanding to a sense that, that when someone has an addiction, they are caught in a physiological process, just like someone who has a virus is caught in a physiological process. It's not an option to stop, press a button and have it stop.
Right. And part of this too is, and then, you know, in my own research in this, you have the pandemic, people are staying at home, their lives have been uprooted, they can't hang out with friends and family, they may have mental health issues before that, things that may have led them down the path of addiction, maybe they were managing their addiction, maybe they weren't, but then along comes the pandemic, that compounds the mental health issue, that makes them seek out drug use, and I mean, it's also a matter of what else is there to do? And people start thinking that way. Mm-hmm. It's just another indication that people are, you know, these things are all intertwined, that you can't silo necessarily drug addiction and the pandemic and mental health issues. Right. They can be all connected too.
Well, they're definitely all connected in terms of someone who is living through all of those things. But, you know, I mean, across the board, substance use has gone up through the pandemic, like the LCBO sales are higher and the cannabis stores are opening. A lot of things are closing, but cannabis stores are opening. It's everybody seems to be needing a little comfort these days. So it's not just people who are accessing the unregulated drug market who may be in a situation where they're using maybe more. What's different is when you buy your bottle of liquor, it tells you exactly how much alcohol is in it and you know what you got.
Right. And it, we kind of laugh it off, too. It's like, oh, look at the lines at the liquor store. And you know, meanwhile, if there was a lineup at the local dealer, we would start tisking those people.
Yeah. It's a lot of, I think if people, again, if we stop and actually really check out where our attitudes are coming from and how we have a lot of double standards, I think all of us have them, right? So it's just like when we hit one, do we stop and examine it, or do we just move on and continue to believe what we believe?
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if we're sort of looking things at from an overall perspective, like a macro perspective. I mean, having one public health issue and having people's attention so galvanized on public health, on that public health aspect, I think, just generally from my point of view, has helped magnify a lot of different public health issues. Like there have been a lot of, been a lot of discussion about isolation, about people who are lonely in this pandemic, and how that is a greater symptom of, you know, society. That has been exacerbated. Can we say the same thing about our approach to drug policy? Like, I mean, we are all focused on COVID and getting through COVID, but I mean, has having that big public push and attention on public health issues helped all aspects of public health, including drug addiction,
I think there's definitely opportunity. I mean, like, I agree with you that something, for whatever reason, this pandemic has kind of been a big revealer. It's like, whatever it is, it's shaken out and we see it more clearly, and whatever the kind of weakness or challenge is, it's more obvious. So within drug policy, for sure, I think there has been opportunity. And so the Canadian Chiefs of Police, Association of Chiefs of Police, had made a statement that they collectively think that personal possession should be decriminalized. So that was back, actually, I think just before the pandemic. So you know, if we could decriminalize at least the personal possession, that is one step forward. So people no longer run a risk of being charged if they, you know, have some, if they're caught with whatever they're using for themselves, or if they, you know, if someone overdoses. I mean, there is the Good Samaritan law, but there's still worry that people are going to be, by association, put into places they don't want to be. So that's one huge piece. And then the whole conversation of safe supply has really moved forward really fast this year. I mean, one of the, Patty Hajdu, the federal minister of health, has in a letter to provincial ministers of health, heads of all regulatory bodies, she basically said, do what you can to make safe supply happen in that letter, because if there's a way to give people pharmaceutical grade substances, they are not having there's a way to manage and control, just like we know the percentage of alcohol in a bottle of liquor, we know the percentage of fentanyl, we know the percentage of whatever it is that someone's taking, that's a manageable process. On the black market, it's crapshoot. So, you know, I mean, moving into that whole process of seeing this as a health issue, that where you would give prescription grade drugs, just as we give prescription grade drugs for almost every other health issue, that that there's really an opportunity to move that forward. And there, again, I kudos to our local services. The Guelph Community Health Center is in the process of just starting a pilot, a very small pilot, but a pilot for safe supply. And the other communities throughout Ontario, I think, are doing the same, which is to really, that's moving away from the stigmatization. That's saying, we know this is a health problem. We're going to treat it like a health problem. We're going to, you know, use whatever we know pharmaceutically. We're going to invite people to come into a healthcare process. We're not going to marginalize them and push them to the edges of society. We're going to, you know, take care. I don't know if you're at all aware of some of the safe supply evaluations, but there's a physician in London, Dr. Andrea Cereda. Her work, if she was working, if the work she was doing was cancer studies, the whole world would have changed what they're doing because of the results of her work. But she's working in addiction, and she's been able to show really great gains by providing people with safe supply. But because it's such a controversial topic and people see that as enabling, or they see, you know, why would you give people who use drugs drugs? Like, it just, it's a complicated decision that you have to actually take some time to think about to decide whether or not it makes sense. So on the surface, it doesn't seem to make sense. It's like, why would you enable somebody? But if you actually stop and look at it, if you move out of that judgment and move into a place of, this is a health issue we need to treat, it starts to make a lot of sense. And what it does is it reduces the fatalities. It allows people to stop spending all day long worrying and stealing and doing whatever they need to do to get the next fix. It really changes the quality of life for the person who is on the receiving end of that treatment. It starts to build bridges into other healthcare. So not only do people get their addiction under control, they get their HIV under control, or they get their pneumonia, their diabetes, their whatever under control.
People forget that if you're getting your drugs from a nurse, the nurse is interested in helping you stop using the drugs. If you're getting your drugs from your dealer, that's the business for that dealer, and he's not interested in losing a customer.
Yeah. Yeah. And the nurse, I mean, depending on her orientation, she's either interested in helping you use so you can use safely, right, or she's interested in helping you find out what your options are if you're interested in changing what your use pattern looks like. But that's it, right. You're right. She's not there to make her own living in the sense that, you know, she needs you to pay her to have her role exist.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. I was just looking out the window. It is snowing right this minute as we're recording this. And I mean, and that's a reminder that, you know, winter is here, you know, meteorologically speaking, if not, you know, speaking in terms of the calendar date. But what are the dangers that you are worried about with you know, the people you're trying to help this winter? Mm-hmm. You know, is this going to be like a different winter? Are you thinking about things differently than this time last year in terms of the help people need?
Well, it's been a tough year, as we just spoke about right at the very beginning. So winter only makes things harder for people who are already feeling that society doesn't want them and that they're living in places that perhaps are very unsafe, or that are, they're sleeping rough. They're out in a tent. They're out trying to figure out how to survive. So yes, it's winter's always so much tougher. And you know, the drug strategy has tried to push some kind of quick and fast solutions. We luckily have some really good solutions coming forward for permanent supportive housing, but they're not necessarily that quick and fast. We were really, the whole idea of trying to use modular units that could be quickly put up really just didn't find resonance. So, from the drug strategy perspective, the work that the Drop-In and Kindle are doing to bring permanent supportive housing and Wyndham House is fabulous. It didn't get done in time to be available before the snow fell.
Mm-hmm. Maybe to wrap up, looking ahead, I mean, there is light at the end of the tunnel in terms of the one pandemic anyway. We've got at least several vaccines on the way. What happens the day after, though, we have that herd immunity in terms of tackling this pandemic? What, I mean, have we learned the lessons? Or and more important than that, we also talked about at the beginning about the progress we had made at the beginning of the year with all these new community supports that had come online. Are you able to sort of jump back in at that point and you know, move forward that way? Or are we just sort of like back to square one and we're going to have to rebuild that again?
Well, I mean, we have, I think, continued to put good services in place, and those services have expanded through the pandemic. And there have been some amazing partnerships where the shelter system and the healthcare system have now got really integrated in a way that they weren't beforehand. And I think that our city has stepped up and said permanent supportive housing is a need that we need to address. So, I mean, there have definitely been some really positive gains in terms of moving the understanding of how we can get out in front of addiction. Addiction per se is it's a symptom of a larger problem, and how we can start to address some of those larger problems. We have had federal health ministers support safe supply. We've had, I think there are some stepping stones that if we can continue to build on, we could really actually find ourselves in a good situation as we move through this. And that, we have the CTS is expanding. They are looking to put a satellite site out at Loyola House. But I think from that kind of treatment side, we're doing, as a community, we're doing a lot to try and help. The big policy sits at a federal level and at a provincial level. And so until we decriminalize, until we put the funding into mental health and addiction that we put into cancer, into other types of disease process, until we do that, there's always going to be this marginalization. And of course, politically, if we continue to, we don't have a guaranteed minimum income, when we expect people to live on $700 or $800 a month in our city, they are going to have to, by definition, do something criminal, probably, to make up that difference. I mean, there are food banks, there are places to go for food, but I would challenge anybody to live on that amount of money and not find themselves shoplifting or not find themselves picking up a phone when it's sat down somewhere or doing any of the things that people do out of necessity.
Yeah, I don't know what I can add to that, but it strikes me as that there's still a long way to go. I mean, although, from the tone of your voice, I think there is hope.
Yeah, I think there's hope too. And I mean, I wouldn't be able to do my job if I didn't think there's hope. And I appreciate your having a podcast like this, and maybe some people will stop and really look a little more closely at the double standards they have and decide why for them addiction has perhaps been a criminal process and not a health process. And what would look different in our community or look different in our province if we switch that understanding and we really moved into treating people who are struggling with a physiological process, and we treated it physiologically and not treating it from a sociological and criminal point of view.
Or just, generally create more empathy, because mm-hmm. I think everybody has had their own unique struggles. Everybody struggled in their own way throughout this. I think people might have a bit understanding of the mental health space that some drug users sort of find themselves in and can relate better, I would mm-hmm. hope. That is certainly my goal.
I really want to speak to that can be when you meet someone who is psychotic because of meth, that can be very scary. So I don't any way want to downplay the individual experience of not feeling safe or not feeling trusting, but it's that individual sits in a much bigger system, and the thing that's going to fix things for that individual and the person who's scared of them is on a systemic level, not on the individual level. And until we, have the kinds of resources we put in place for other challenges, where someone can quickly and timely way get the help they need, and where they have a place to live, where they can get better, and where they have the kind of supports around them that help them to get better, we're just going to keep seeing Groundhog Day.
Well, Groundhog Day is a great way to put that, and it speaks to the values. Like, do you want to help someone who is addicted to meth so that they will not scare another person through their addiction behaviors? Or do you just sort of want to let it happen again mm-hmm. and again and again? And perhaps that is a philosophical question we'll have to leave with the listener. As mm-hmm. I said to you, Adrian, we could talk about this for 3 hours, but I know you have very pressing time.
Thank you, Adam. I really appreciate the opportunity. And, it's a heavy topic. So thanks to anybody who's listened, because I appreciate their willingness to give this some thought.
I just want to do a quick sign off so I can end the recording. Well, Adrian, thank you again for all your time. And we will keep our eye out on how we can help resolve this other pandemic and not make it quite as secondary once we get through this other bigger one. So thank you for your time again.
You're welcome. Thank you, Adam.
And once again, that was Adrienne Crowder. To learn more about Wellington Guelph Drug Strategy and their programs, you can visit their website at wgdrugstrategy.ca. And to learn more about the consumption and treatment site and other programs, you can visit the Guelph Community Health Center at their website, guelphchc.ca. And that is it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is usually recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus. And to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can download it from the host at Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you'll get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. You can reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. There is also Guelph Politico on Facebook, which you can find at facebook.com/politicalguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, please consider donating to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you next week. And until then, see you next time.